So this particular, here we go. This particular lecture deals with the issue of the governing equations, essentially. Is going? Yes, okay, good. So this is an example of the code that you're actually going to be using for one of the geodynamics tutorials. It's a sitcom that was written by Luis Morisi, and what it's showing is the onset of convection in a layer which is heated from below and cooled from above. You can see the blue stuff sinking down, the red stuff rising up. As it evolves a little bit further, you'll start to notice that the interior part, which used to be blue and red, starts to go sort of a white color. This is sort of your vanilla bland mantle convection, classic Bernard Rayleigh convection. I hope at the end of this lecture you're going to understand why these colors in the center fade out and why the most intense colors tend to appear at the boundary layers. We're going to sort of present the equations that underlie the mathematical description of this and then talk about some of the approximations and scaling relations that we use to sort of characterize these sorts of systems. One of the things that distinguishes the Earth perhaps from this Bernard Rayleigh style convection is the fact that, among other things, the rheology, the viscosity of this material, its sort of ability to deform or tendency to deform, is highly temperature dependent. And that actually makes a huge difference in the rheologies. And so you're going to explore these sort of simple models in the tutorial to sort of get a basic idea of how these things work. And then you're going to move on and also explore some of these more temperature dependent viscosities, and this is an example of that. And you'll see that compared with the last one, you'll find that this behavior is actually quite a bit different. So the layer that's blue now is very, very cold, and that makes it very, very stiff. It's unlikely to deform. So this thermal plume kind of rises up and kind of impinges on this sort of cold, tough layer, gradually kind of erodes it away because it heats it up. But again, the style of convection is very, very different. Again, you're going to have the opportunity to run these codes, play around with them, put different parameters in, and sort of get a sense, a physical sense, of how these systems work. I mean, in some ways, this is a little bit more like the Earth in the sense that you have very cold, tough material at the top, very low viscosity material at the bottom. And so one of the things that these sorts of calculations tend to do is they produce plumes, which we talked a little bit about last time. It's hard to keep plumes down, I guess, in these things. So we'll let this run just another couple of minutes, or a couple of seconds, hopefully. And then we'll press on with the equations that underlie this stuff. There's a plume coming up. This is strictly 2D. This is strictly 2D, yeah. In fact, you know, it's funny, I had to actually get an old version of this code from Luis because I didn't think that we could probably run 3D calculations in any sensible sort of time frame for the tutorials. But this is strictly 2D, yeah. To be honest with you, I don't actually know. And I couldn't figure it out, actually, yeah. I can tell you that the interior part is temperature. This is actually a really nice piece of code, and Luis has done, I think, a really enormous service to the community by making this code available. And in fact, it's a tar file on the system, so I would actually encourage all of you to take a copy of the tar file. It's very easy to compile and run and use, and I think you'll find it actually quite useful. Okay.
Did that have any pressure dependence in this
code? This did not, actually, no. So all of the variations were just due to temperature, which is almost mimics a pressure dependence because of the temperature gradient down through it. Okay, so let's begin. This is mute. Good. Oops. So this is a lot of stuff. I thought that I was going to actually go about half an hour last time. We went full hour. I have much more this time, so let's see what happens. Okay, so the governing equations. This is really classic physics, I think, and you know, there's a variety of ways that you can approach this. Well, first let me tell you what's involved. We're going to have sort of two sets of equations. One are the conservation equations, which tell us about the things that have to be conserved during the flow. Things like we expect mass to be conserved, we expect Newton's laws of motion to be obeyed, conservation momentum, we would like heat to be conserved, that sort of stuff. And that's a big part of these equations, but we also have to prescribe physical properties, things like the equations of state, which are the things that you talked about yesterday in the tutorial. How does the density change with temperature and composition and pressure and those sorts of things? And also the rheology. How does the material deform when it's subjected to stresses? And I think from the point of view of the difficulty of the problem, this is really the, I think, probably the most difficult aspect of the problem. Now there are a variety of paths that we can take to get these governing equations, and the approach that I thought that we would take today is the high road, what I would call the high road. The view's nicer, but it requires a little bit more in terms of background. But I think the advantage of it is it lets you see the physics or a clearer picture of what the equations are actually telling you, so that you'll look at them and they'll speak to you in a sense. And so everything that we're going to, all we need really to derive all of our conservation equations is this thing called the Reynolds transport theorem. And so the idea is that if you have a fluid and we have some property of the fluid, which we'll just simply call F, and we want to add up all the, take up a fluid and imagine it's broken up into a bunch of little parcels and then add up the contributions of all those parcels to give us some integral quantity, which we'll call F, what we're going to do is sort of track the time variations in this F to get our governing equations. And so this volume that we're integrating over, I'm going to call a material volume. And the way to think about it is, imagine you've got this volume of particles, and I'm putting little tags on each of them. And then as time evolves, those particles move. And so the volume that sort of sketches out those particles change as a function of time. And so as a consequence, when I take the derivative of this quantity F with respect to T, essentially applying it to the derivative, I can't just simply take this derivative inside and apply it to F like this. I get this extra piece. And the reason is that this volume, this material volume, is actually going with the flow. So it's also changing with time. So there's a contribution to the interior which is related to the fact that the volume changes. And this V here is the fluid velocities. So sort of the physical picture is you've got this swarm of particles. They've all got labels. Here's the volume at some initial time in a dashed line here. At some later time, it evolves with the flow. And basically, this is the volume that we're keeping track of. And so we're going to apply Reynolds transport theorem over and over and over, hopefully an increasingly fast pace, to sort of see how all of these conservation equations emerge. And so we'll start with mass, because it's the easiest, and it's probably the most informative application of Reynolds transport theorem. So let's talk about the mass of this volume. It's just the sum of the densities, or the sum of the masses, of all the particles. So we just integrate or sum over all those particles to get the mass involving the density. And so conservation of mass simply requires that the mass of those parcels, as they move through the fluid, don't change. We're not adding, we're not subtracting. And so we're just simply going to apply the derivative to this function, in this particular case, density. This was the Reynolds transport theorem, which has to be equal to zero. And it also has to be true regardless of what volume we use. So we could take a big volume, we could take a little subvolume within that volume. And so the point is that it has to be satisfied for any volume. And the way that that's going to be true for any volume is if this integrand, this part inside the integral, is identically zero at all points. And if that's true, then basically this will be satisfied and this becomes our conservation of mass equation. Okay. So again, it's just basically define the quantity that you want, in this particular case mass, take the derivative and say what does the derivative of mass have to be? It has to be zero, doesn't change, and out pops your conservation of mass equation, which is one of the three conservation equations that we need. Okay, well in mantle dynamics, there's a lot of approximations that people use. Two are probably the most common. And generally what we're thinking about is very slow creeping flows. So it's the opposite of seismology in a sense. We normally imagine that the densities do change as material is advected around through the interior, but it happens so slowly that the rate of change of density is small enough that we can neglect. And if we just simply toss that term away, we're left with an approximation which is commonly known as the anelastic approximation. It's just the divergence of the density times the fluid velocities equaling zero. And increasingly, I think this is the approximation that people are using in codes more and more because it is more realistic. The conventional approach has been what's known as the Boussinesq approximation, goes back over 100 years. And the idea is that you say the density is basically, we're going to approximate it as a constant. And the only place where we care about when density varies from a constant is when we're thinking about the buoyancy term, when stuff's a little bit hotter and therefore less dense and rises, or stuff's a little bit colder and a little bit less or more dense and sinks. So in every place other than the buoyancy term, the Boussinesq approximation replaces the density with a constant. We can take that constant outside of this divergence, and we're left with the divergence of the velocity is equal to zero, which is completely equivalent to the idea that the fluid is incompressible. So incompressible, Boussinesq approximation, they're identical. Okay? So there's one of the conservation equations. Good. How about momentum equation? It's almost the same idea. We'll call the momentum of this collection of particles, we'll just simply add all the momentums of all those different parcels, the momentum just being the velocity times the density of those parcels. We add them up over the total volume that we're thinking about and define that as the total momentum of this volume. And Newton's second law tells us that the change in the momentum of that fluid parcels has to equal the sum of the forces that act on it, right? This is F equals ma. So we again apply the derivative to the momentum and then equate this to all the forces which actually act on the fluid. So now we just have to think about what those forces are. Okay, this is normally separated into two kinds of forces. One are the body forces, which are like gravity. So for example, this is a force which acts over the entire volume of the body. And the other type of forces are surface forces, like pressure. And so you could imagine your fluid parcel sort of sitting here. You've got pressure acting on the whole surface. If the pressure distribution isn't uniform around it, maybe the pressure over here is a little bit higher than the pressure over here, then there could be a tendency to drive this parcel in this direction. And so the net force, basically, is just the sum of the pressure over the entire surface. Just add up all the little patches of surface to find out if there's a net force in one direction or the other. And then the integral over the volume gives us the buoyancy force. And again, normally we'll be thinking about F as, in fact, a buoyancy force. Now, this is for the inviscid case. What that means is a fluid which will have no viscosity. It would be sort of thinking a bit like water. Almost no resistance to shear. But in fact, viscous fluids actually are more complicated than this. And the way to think about it, perhaps, is that if I impose a surface on this force, for example, I can impose a horizontal surface by sort of putting a little friction on the surface, pushing horizontally. So there's no requirement, really, in a viscous fluid that these forces which act on the surface be perpendicular to the surface. Okay? I can have horizontal forces on this surface, and what that requires me to generalize this notion of this pressure to the idea of a tensor. And you've probably seen this before, perhaps, and I'm not going to go really into any detail on the backgrounds for this tensor, but it's just what we require for the more general description of the forces that act on the surface. Okay. Right, so if we then substitute this tensor rather than the pressure into here, we just simply add up all the contributions of the stress over the surface, add them all up, integrate the body forces. This gives us the net force on the parcel, and that must equal the rate of change of momentum of the fluid parcel. Now the last piece of apparatus that we'll use, so it's Reynolds transport theorem and this guy are the only two pieces of machinery that we really need to get these equations. And this is just the divergence theorem, the fact that the tensor dotted into the normal vector and then averaged over the whole surface or added up over the whole surface can be expressed equivalently as the divergence of that quantity integrated over the whole volume. And the attraction of doing that is then that both of these guys are expressed as volume integrals. Okay, so just those two things are the only price of admission in terms of actually deriving all these equations. Okay, so Reynolds transport theorem for momentum becomes that the rate of change of momentum, which is given by this quantity, which can be expanded out like this, must be equal to the sum of the forces which act on that parcel. Okay, that's the momentum equation. That's Newton's law, F equals ma. And it's the same story again, because this must be true for arbitrary volumes, big volume, little volume, inside what we're talking about, the integrand must be identically equal to zero, and out pops our momentum equation. Now, one of the things that I say here is it can be shown, right? Whenever you read that in the paper, you know you're in trouble, right? Because it means that the author either couldn't be bothered or couldn't figure out a good, easy way to explain it. But maybe what you can see, perhaps, is there's a change in density here, and that there's sort of a divergence rho v, which kind of looks like bits and pieces of the conservation of mass equation. And so if you use the conservation of mass, so expanded this out, use the conservation of mass equation, you can kill off some bits, and then you're ending up left with this. Okay. Right. So, in mantle convection, the forces that we're worried about are the viscous stresses, essentially due to the deformation of the material, which we're going to represent like this, There's a pressure term plus another component of the stress, which is solely due to the fact that you're deforming the material. And then the force that almost exclusively we're going to worry about then is the buoyancy force, which depends on the density difference and the acceleration due to gravity at that particular point. Okay? So there's the conservation of mass equation and the momentum equation now derived with Running's transport theorem and the divergence theorem. Okay, last one. Conservation of heat. This one actually turns out to be a bit tricky. And so to make life a little bit easier, I'm going to suppose that essentially a Boussinesq type approximation and say that the density and the specific heat are constant. Okay? I don't have to do this, and in fact the equation's not so different from what we end up getting, but this will make our life easy. So then we'll say, all right, well, the heat we can define in this approximation is just the sum of the specific heat, the temperature of each parcel added up over all of the parcels. And so conservation of heat just simply tells us about how the heat changes inside the fluid as a function of either heat that we add or heat that we lose. And so there's two possibilities. We have this heat content inside our parcel of fluid. We can either lose heat from this parcel by conduction, or we can add heat by having some sort of internal heat source, like radioactivity, which we talked a little bit about yesterday. So the last equation is that the change in the heat content as a function of time equals the sum of the heat that's lost over the entire surface plus the generation of heat which occurs inside the body. And so again, repetition of that usual recipe basically gives us the conservation of energy equation. You often assume that the heat flow is given by Fourier's law, which says that the loss of heat depends on the temperature gradient and thermal conductivity. We can pop that right there. Yep?
Now, why are you calling this conservation of heat instead of conservation of energy, in the sense that there is a missing deformation power in the energy equation?
Right. So here's the subtlety. Yes. Okay. Reason why I don't call it energy is I would call the conservation of energy equation one which was the rate of change of internal energy. And so then what I've done in deriving this equation is essentially sort of take off that part and get essentially a change in entropy or heat content, essentially. So the you're right. You would say, well, look, if I'm deforming material, I'm producing shear heating, for example, in the fluid. Surely that's a heat source. Absolutely it is. But when you actually allow for the compressibility of the material, what you find is that the heat source due to viscous dissipation exactly cancels, and it's not obvious. This is what I mean by it being tricky. If you're interested, I love this stuff, so I'd be happy to talk about it. But bottom line is this term, it's basically V dot grad S, where entropy exactly balances the dissipation in the system. Exactly. And it's required by conservation of energy. And you often see papers, actually even Dan McKenzie once made this mistake, actually. So it happens to everybody, right? Okay. So again, I mean, I went through that really quickly, I realized, because I have so much other stuff that I wanted. What's that? What was that? Okay, well, I'll tell you what paper to send along with that as well. But there was a paper that came out later, the McKenzie-Hewitt. That was the paper, I think, that came out in response to this earlier paper where there was a mistake. Sorry, Dan. Okay, summary. Yeah, I forgot about that audio tape. Okay, summary of equations. We have conservation of mass, we have conservation of momentum, we have conservation of heat. If you, again, this is really quick, I realize, but you can look at these equations and maybe see where they've come from, right? So here's the change in the momentum. This is the MA of Newton's law. And then this is the sum of the forces that act on the fluid. This is basically the change in the heat content inside that parcel of fluid. And here's basically the things that contribute to the loss or gain of heat, conduction from the parcel of fluids or generation of heat from radioactivity. So I think the key is to be able to look at these equations and think about what do they actually mean? What are they actually telling you? And so I think that the advantage of the approach that we just described is I think it's a little bit closer to the physical interpretation of these equations. Okay. So what do we solve for? We try to determine the fluid velocities V, and we try to determine the temperature T. And so in order to close these equations, we need just a couple of extra pieces of information. We need to know how to evaluate the density perturbation here, and we need to evaluate the stresses here in terms of the temperature and velocity. So we're going to solve for these two guys, but we'll need to be able to evaluate these two guys in terms of these two things. Yep?
Given the big temperature contrast between the upper mantle and the lower mantle, and how reasonable is it to assume a constant conductivity? I'm not sure if that really...
I would bet that that's probably less important than some other things that vary. For example, we talked a little bit yesterday about variations in thermal expansion, for example. Probably more important. But sure, it makes a difference. It could vary in order of magnitude. So could thermal expansion. And the attraction of the thermal expansion is that's your driving force. The thermal conductivity is essentially dissipating heat. So when you see one of those plumes rising up, what enhanced thermal conductivity is going to do is make it evaporate or disappear as it rises up, as it conducts its heat to the surroundings. So it's also important. In fact, we'll be able to see how these various terms influence convection once we get to the dimensionless form. Okay, so this then turns to the issue of physical properties, right? To close these equations, we need to know things about the fluid that we're trying to solve. So Lars yesterday talked a little bit about equations of state. You know, give your favorite composition, pressure, temperature, what's the density of that material? In convection, we're almost always dealing with relatively small perturbations and densities. And so it's pretty reasonable to linearize these equations of state and just go with things like the coefficient of thermal expansion or the counterpart for the compositional case, which is just the partial derivative of the density with respect to temperature or the density with respect to composition at fixed P and C, right? Okay, what's that? Okay, so with this linearization, we can say then that the density perturbation is related to the temperature perturbation relative to some reference state. And the reference state is the one that we use to differentiate these things. So for example, your reference state might be an adiabatic prem, for example. And we would just simply be linearizing the density perturbations about that. So in that case, this would be the prem density, this would be the adiabatic density, and this might be some well-mixed pyrolyte composition, for example. Okay. The second equation is the constitutive equation, and this is really where all the difficulty lies, I think. How do we relate the surface forces that act on this material as a function of the rate at which it deforms? A variety of different forms are possible, but generally speaking, the stress, the viscous stress, is normally related to the strain rate tensor, which tells us something about the rate at which this fluid material is deforming. So the most common approximation for this constitutive relation is the Newtonian fluid. And that's indicated here. The stress, the total stress, is basically includes a pressure component, just a normal surface force, the normal pressure that you often think about. And then this term, which is linear in the deformation rate. So this is the simplest model that you could think of. And then this coefficient of proportionality is just what we refer to as the viscosity. Yep. If you want me to, I can do that. Well, I don't think I called it thermal expansion.
So it's a partial molar volume.
Some people in convection call it beta.
It's the volume change that you would get when you go through a phase transition.
No, let's say I changed iron content. Well, how does the volume change? Or if I change whatever my parameter that I'm characterizing composition by, basically. So in the core, for example, that's light elements, for example. This is my always fallback position. So for example, I think iron is a sensible thing because it looks like iron variations may, in fact, play an important role in the dynamics of the mantle. So you'd certainly want to include an additional buoyancy parameter that affected those variations. Okay, so there's the simple one, the Newtonian viscosity. That's the rheology that I used on the very first movie or simulation actually adopted a simple Newtonian viscosity, a linear relationship between the stress and the strain rate. But there's lots of generalizations. The second one that I showed assumed that the viscosity was strongly dependent on temperature. Normally, when the temperature goes up, the viscosity goes way down and the material becomes much more deformable. On the other hand, when the temperature becomes low, the material gets very stiff. And we sort of intuitively think that plates are this very stiff, high viscosity material, but it turns out it's almost certainly that it's more complicated than that. So the temperature dependence is very often represented, at least often represented in this form. You'll notice yet another gamma, right? It's a very popular symbol. You could actually add the influences of pressure to this form if you wanted to, just simply by replacing the temperature with the homologous temperature, which is the ratio of the temperature to the melt temperature. And this is often done. And this is often a very simple way of incorporating the pressure dependence. So the viscosity really is dependent on how far away you are from the melting temperature. And then there's a variety of power laws, which are probably appropriate for the mantle, which relate the stress and strain in a nonlinear way. And you can still represent you can still think about the viscosity in a sense, and still think about this relationship here as describing these two, but you have to allow this viscosity then to be dependent on the stress, or conversely, the strain. And so this is sort of a typical form that you might find, where this is the viscosity at some reference stress, and then this is the deviation in stress and viscosity from that. Typical values for this power exponent are order 3, perhaps a little bit higher. And so what that means is that this is a negative exponent. Okay. So basically, if you want to think about it, some positive exponent there, and then flip this, so that the bigger the stress becomes, the lower the viscosity is. And so the basic character of these power law relations is the more you deform them, the more easily they become to be deformed. And it tends to sort of focus the deformation into narrow regions. And it was thought for a while that perhaps power law relations might actually give you plate-like behaviors. But in fact, it turns out that they don't seem to. One of the more recent advances, I guess, which people have been looking at is to introduce even more complicated rheologies, and in particular plastic failure characteristics. And these have been done, among others, by Paul Tackley. And these just show some results of his calculations in sort of these very flat or large aspect ratio Cartesian boxes. What's being shown here is essentially a variety of simulations with increasing yield stress. So what this is the material behaves basically elastically up to a point. It hits a certain stress, and then it fails plastically. And so what these simulations are doing is just basically the point at which stuff fails is going to higher and higher and higher stress. And so if you have very, very low yield stress, the material fails very, very easily, you get a convective pattern which is not too different from regular isothermal convection. But as you start to increase the yield stress, you can actually start to get plate-like behavior. These colors are actually the log of the viscosity. So these red regions in the interior are regions of very, very high stress. So these are going to behave like plates. And the region in between, blue, represent very, very low viscosities. All the deformation has been focused into these regions. And so you're getting sort of plate-like behavior. Push the stress, the yield stress up a little bit higher, and essentially the whole surface never fails, and you just get this tough, stagnant lid that covers the entire top of the convection, which is very unearth-like. So this is sort of most earth-like. This is perhaps more like Venus and Mars, and this is more like the standard Bernard-Rayleigh convection. So one pressing question, I suppose, is how did Earth actually get into that state? And most people suppose that water plays some role in the story. Okay. Let's turn now to the dimensionless equations, because a lot of the insight that we get in terms of thinking about these equations, in terms of scaling these equations, and understanding their behavior, comes by writing them in dimensionless form. So the point is that we customarily measure time in seconds, we measure distance in meters, or some of us do, or Kelvin in temperature. But this is not obviously, or not necessarily, the most useful set of scales. We could choose other length scales, other time scales, other temperature scales that might be more convenient. And so, for example, for a layer, fluid layer here, which is heated from below, they might develop a conductive temperature profile like this. A more sensible length scale to use in the problem might be the thickness of the fluid layer. And so we might measure distances, say, in fractions of L. And similarly, the temperature perturbation, Kelvin might not be the most obvious choice. Maybe fractions of this temperature difference between the top and the bottom would be a useful temperature scale or temperature measure. And so very often what we do is we introduce these characteristic distances or lengths, L, characteristic temperature as such, And essentially what we're doing is saying that the real temperature in Kelvin is given by this temperature scale times some non-dimensional value. So in this particular case, here, the non-dimensional temperature goes from 0 at the top to 1 at the bottom. It's very convenient. Similarly, these coordinates, our position coordinate has some characteristic length scale times this dimensionless coordinate. So we're going to adopt a new coordinate system. So again, if we think about the z-coordinate, which goes from perhaps 0 at the surface of the Earth to about 3 million meters, roughly speaking, if we choose L to be our length scale to be the thickness of this layer, then the z-prime coordinate goes from basically 0 to 1 at the bottom. Again, just a more convenient choice of units to use. And so here's the idea. The governing equations involve terms like the derivative of temperature with respect to depth, for example. And so if I then express that derivative in terms of these quantities, I get this term for the temperature gradient. So this constant term pulls out front, which is a delta T by L. This is sort of a characteristic temperature gradient in the system. And if I've chosen my scales wisely, this will be the order of magnitude of this temperature gradient. And this number here will be sort of order 1, minus 1, plus 1, sort of somewhere in that range. Okay? We can do the same thing very often in the time scales. We often adopt a diffusion time scale, which is the distance of the fluid squared divided by the thermal diffusivity. So we introduce these scales. We then convert the equations to non-dimensional form in terms of quantities of T primed and Z primed and see what ends up happening. So in the notes, this is actually worked through in detail for you, so you can actually work through that and see how it works. Here's kind of like the final result. Summary of dimensionless equations. It's our conservation of mass equation, conservation of momentum equation, and conservation of heat. Okay? And the remarkable thing about these equations is that almost all the coefficients in front of them, like density, the coefficient of thermal expansion, the thermal conductivity, all those parameters have been kind of amalgamated into these two terms. One here and one here. There's no other parameters which appear in front of these variables. Everything's been collapsed into this and into that. These two numbers, the combinations of parameters, this PR is the Prandtl number, which is the viscosity essentially divided by the thermal diffusivity. And the other one's the Rayleigh number, which depends on things like density, coefficient of thermal expansion, the temperature difference across the layer, gravity, the thickness of the layer to the cube power. Warning, I'm going to change this to D later, so you're advised, and viscosity and diffusivity. So these are the things that promote convection on the top. Big temperature gradients, large distances, big gravity, lots of thermal expansion promote convection. Things that damp convection, things like viscosity and diffusion of heat, work against it. And so this number is in some ways a measure of the vigor of convection. It's a useful way to think about it. Okay. If we put in typical numbers for these parameters, we find out that the Prandtl number is 10 to the 24. It's huge. Okay? The Rayleigh number for this particular case, taking I think 2,000 degrees for delta T, is about 10 to the 7th. So when you look at these equations, if we've chosen the scales correctly, all of these terms here will be about order 1. And so we have 1 over 10 to the 24 times quantities which are order 1, times a whole bunch of quantities which are order 1, times something which is 10 to the 7th, it seems a safe bet that you can essentially kill this term off, just drop it. And so in mantle convection papers, you often hear this described as infinite Prandtl number. So 10 to the 24 in mantle dynamics then is considered to be infinity. So if anyone ever asks you, you know now what infinity is. It's at least 10 to the 24 or so. The great attraction of that is that the equations only depend on one dimensionless number, the Rayleigh number. So I can change density, I can change coefficient of thermal expansion, I can change the gravity field, go to a different planet. But if I don't change the Rayleigh number, the convection style of convection does not change. Okay? This is really, really powerful because it means that you can do a laboratory experiment, and as long as you get the Rayleigh number about right, that experiment will be relevant for the Earth. Okay? Actually, you know, when you see these old James Bond movies, right? You know, Dr. No, probably my favorite. And when they're sort of, when they're filming disasters, right? Like ships exploding and stuff happening, what they do is they film models, right? And you know that it looks hokey. But what they do is they film it and they slow the camera down to kind of make it look about right. But the reason why they can't get it right, in any problem with a free surface, there's two dimensionless numbers, essentially, a Reynolds number and a Froude number. And the problem is, just by adjusting time, you can't get those two numbers right. You can get one close, but not the other. You kind of compromise. And so always these things look hokey because they just can't do it right. If they could maybe go to a different planet with a different G, then I think if they could control G, then they could basically do it. So the great virtue of special effects is it frees you from hokey movies, I guess. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that is a good point. So, okay, remember this was our F equals MA. We're saying that MA is equal to zero, so the mantle is not accelerating. And so all the forces at each instant in time are perfectly balanced. And that's exactly as Caroline says. All the time dependence comes from the advection of thermal anomalies around through the fluid. Okay. So let's see if we can actually use the fact that the Rayleigh number is the only number in the parameter that characterizes convection. I mean, again, this is hugely powerful. So here's the structure of convection, we think. Two cases we'll consider. One case we're imagining we're going to heat it from below. The other case we'll imagine we'll produce our heat through radioactive heating. This might not be in your notes, is it? It is, okay. I couldn't remember whether I included this. Maybe this part's not there. I meant to say that earlier. Don't be alarmed if there's stuff that we're talking about that's not in the notes, because some of this stuff was motivated by the discussions yesterday. Yeah, Abby.
I just have another quick question about
yes.
How small does your spatial scale have to be before you start breaking down?
Like,
if the atomic scale, can you consider a Rayleigh number?
Well, you know, I suspect that you have to at least have the continuum approximation be valid, right? But I guess as long as the continuum approximation is valid, I can't imagine any problems. I mean, for example, physicists do very elegant couette experiments with liquid helium, right, in tiny little apparatus, and they study bifurcations of instabilities that develop in those flows. But that's maybe not what you're asking.
Yeah, I mean, a tiny little piece is still...
Right, atoms. Yeah, sure,
yeah,
right.
I just wondered when you start talking about, micromechanisms,
I mean, I would just leave it as this way, is that as long as you can apply the continuum approximation, then I think that the fluid mechanics is probably going to be okay. Okay, so, pressing on. Right, so here's our situation. We're heating from below. We've got this adiabatic interior. We've got this boundary layer at the top. We've got a boundary layer at the bottom. You remember in that simulation where it was initially... blue at the top, red at the bottom, and then as it evolved, it kind of got white in the interior, kind of neutral colors. Why? Because you have hot at the bottom, but the hot is confined to a thin boundary layer. You've kind of got neutral mid-range colors in the middle where it's well mixed, and you've got a boundary layer at the top. So the reason why it went sort of blank in the center was because we were developing this adiabatic core, in effect. Okay? We've got conduction, heat being transmitted into the fluid by conduction along these steep boundary layer profiles. Once we get into the well-mixed region, though, heat can be carried by fluid motions. And then to get heat out the top, you've got to conduct it out the top. And so in order to get it out the top, you have to develop these, again, steep boundary layers, thermal boundary layers, to get the heat out by convection. The picture looks a little bit different if it's internally heated. Here we have, say, no heat coming in the bottom. All the heat that's basically coming out of the system is being produced by the decay of radioactive, and we only get a boundary layer at the top. These two are sort of end-member cases. The Earth is probably somewhere in between, but I thought it might be interesting in the context of some of the things that Stan talked about to ask, where are we in terms of the Earth? Are we closer to this model? Are we closer to this model? And so sort of a typical estimate for the heat flux out of the surface, once I subtract off the continental part, which doesn't actually play any role in mantle dynamics, we're sitting at around, say, 37 terawatts. We think, according to that model, the 2.5 chondritic, right, something on the order of 20 terawatts. And so the difference between these two, what's coming out the top minus what's being generated in the interior, must be the part that's responsible for cooling. And this is going to be partitioned partly between the mantle and partly between the core. And so let's say, roughly speaking, it's 50-50, which would be generous, I think, for the core in some ways. then we're basically saying that perhaps as much as 28 terawatts out of this 37 are basically in this mode, and the other 8 are coming from heating from below. So it's primarily in this, it appears that it's primarily in this sort of system, provided this model is right. On the other hand, if we were to take the heat flow that's missing, at least based on Morb estimates, and put it in the core, then we would probably flop back into that state instead. True, and I've tossed away part of it. I've tossed away the part that's in the crust, which would be the additional part that gets you up to 44, because it's sort of out of the system. It's sitting in this buoyant, what I describe often as pond scum on the top, and doesn't really play a role in the dynamics. Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it is. The numbers that I was looking at last night said about 8 terawatts versus 20, so about a third. Crust, yes. Way too low. Okay, well then, that's interesting, because then this number will come way down then. So you basically take your chondrite, right? 2.5 chondrite. You subtract 8 from it and put it in the crust, and the rest is the 20. So the total that I would, looking up what I was looking at last night, was 28 terawatts of radiogenic heat.
So you're saying 8 over 28 basically is a very small fraction.
Yeah. Sounds like something to talk about. Okay. Pressing on. Okay. Sorry about the pace, but we're getting there. All right, so what we want to do now is we want to just talk a little bit about some approximate solutions. This to me is great. Sure, that's right. That's true, yeah. No, that's right. That's true, yeah. In fact, if you had the internal heated versus the basal heated, you would find out that when you did those non-dimensional equations, that your Rayleigh number had a slightly different form. That's quite true. Okay. All right. Where are we going with this? Okay. This is something that I really like because, okay, you've got these partial differential equations, and they're pretty complicated. And it's possible, on the other hand, though, to get estimates of the amount of heat which comes out of the system without having to solve that full system of partial differential equations. Estimate. Okay, these are approximate solutions. But it's amazing, actually, that you're able to do this. And it actually works pretty well. And so, in fact, one of the assignments, tutorials, I guess, if the geodynamics group goes today, what we'll have you do is model the cooling of a cup of coffee using these ideas. And you could actually do the experiment and see how good a job it does. I don't know if we have thermometers or we can do this. We maybe can look into that, okay? But this is an example of what fluid mechanics people call scaling relations. What it really is just using a lot of physical insight to think about what's really going on. Okay? And, okay. That's how I look at it anyways. It's just common sense, really, isn't it? So here's our boundary layer. We're going to kind of zoom in on where all the action is. We've got this adiabatic, well-mixed core, boring. All the action basically is in the boundary layer. So we've got this region here where we've got a conductive profile. It's all well mixed into the interior. There's some boundary layer thickness, and essentially what we'd really like to know is what's the thickness of that boundary layer. Because if I knew what the thickness of the boundary layer is, and I know that all the heat in this region is being carried by conduction, then I can just use a conductive formula to tell me how much heat is coming out the top. I don't need to know what's happening down in here. This is simple. This is conduction. And so if I knew what the boundary layer was, I know that the heat flow coming out of the system would be given by this conduction formula. So the trick, if you like, is to figure out what's this boundary layer of thickness. And how does it vary with parameters of interest? Okay. So we're going to assume, and I think this seems reasonable, you know, the other boundary is very, very far away, that the thickness of this boundary is going to be governed by processes which kind of go on in the vicinity of that boundary. And what that means is that the thickness really doesn't, or the determination of the thickness really isn't dependent on exactly where that other boundary is. Okay, this is just an assumption. But it's the only assumption that we'll make to carry this whole argument through. So if you believe that, that just what's going on in this very thin boundary layer is governed by the processes in the vicinity of that boundary layer, it has no idea where that other layer is on the other side of this well-mixed region, then we can say that this boundary layer thickness then must be independent of L. So that's an assumption, and let's see where it gets us. Good, okay. Right, so here's our convective profile again, okay? And, oh, one thing that I did mean to say, sorry, I apologize, that it's clear if I'm looking at this particular case here, right? It really doesn't matter whether I'm thinking about the internally heated case or the basally heated case, right? I don't care what the other boundary layer is looking at. I'm saying everything's governed by what's happening here. So I'm actually going to use the heated from below case to actually do the analysis, but I don't have to, okay? It's just easier. All right, the convective profile for the basally heated case looks like this. We were zoomed in on this little part right here. Now you see I've changed delta T to the total change across the layer, so that the change across the boundary layer is then delta T by 2. So there's our conductive profile again. The delta is basically the thickness of that layer. And I can think about a hypothetical condition where convection doesn't happen and where I only have conduction. So I have heat at the bottom. Heat just conducts along a gradient toward the top. In this hypothetical case, the conduction of heat would just simply be given by K delta T divided by the thickness of the layer. So there I've changed back to D again. This used to be L, now it's D, thickness of the layer, okay? And so I'm going to define a dimensionless ratio, which is the ratio of the heat that's actually coming out of my real convecting system and the heat that comes out of this hypothetical conducting state. And the point is that this dimensionless ratio, which we call the Nusselt number, I'm going to say has to depend on the Rayleigh number, right? Because I've got a non-dimensional parameter, this dimensionless heat flow, coming from a set solution of a set of dimensionless equations that only depend on the Rayleigh number. So it has no choice, but it absolutely has to be a function of the Rayleigh number. I don't know what function at this particular stage, but I know that this has to be a function of this because the governing equations only depend on the Rayleigh number. All right? So if I actually put the definitions of these two guys here and here into this Nusselt number, you'll see that lots of parameters actually cancel. I get D divided by 2 delta. And I've also made the assumption, the only assumption I've made so far, except for infinite Prandtl number, is that this delta is independent of where that other boundary is. It's independent of D. Okay? So let's see what the consequence of that is. All right. What's the consequence? Okay, so what's the dependence? Well, here we go again. Here's the Nusselt number involving these, the thickness of the layer, the thickness of the boundary layer, has to be some function of the Rayleigh number. There's the definition of my Rayleigh number again, explicitly for you, so you don't have to look back and see. What sort of function of a Rayleigh number would have that delta be, how should I say, such that delta is independent of D? Okay, let me get this straight. So if delta is independent of D, then this Nusselt number must be linearly dependent on D. Is that clear? This is really key. I'll say it again, okay? If delta is independent of D by my assumption that it doesn't care where the other boundary is, I have a D here. This is independent of D. That means that the Nusselt number varies linearly with D. Okay? Here's my Rayleigh number, something, 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 D to the cubed, right? What function do I need? Nusselt number equals Rayleigh number to the 1/3. Take the 1/3 of this, that D cubed becomes D, right? And I'm there. Okay? So the Nusselt number, the heat flow, a dimensionless measure of the heat flow coming out of the Earth, must be proportional to the third root of the Rayleigh number. And since I would expect that the Nusselt number would get closer and closer to the conductive state as I got closer and closer to the state where convection suddenly turned off, we define this value of the Rayleigh number where convection begins as the critical value, which I had in notes but didn't have time to talk about, then I can actually say that the ratio of the Rayleigh number to the critical value all raised to the third power, so this becomes the constant of proportionality, gives me the heat flow. In the Earth, that's a number of about 20. So mantle convection makes heat transport out of the Earth about 20 times more efficient than it would be if it was conduction. I have an estimate of the heat flow then as just this hypothetical value, which I can calculate. The Nusselt number, which only depends on Rayleigh number, so I can calculate. Okay? If I know the heat flow, I can go back and estimate what the boundary layer thickness was, and that for the Earth comes out to be about 70 kilometers, which you could think of as, say, being the time average thickness of the oceanic plate, for example. And so, in fact, this simple scaling argument gives us actually very, very good estimates for the thickness of the boundary layers. It gives us pretty reasonable estimates for the heat flow. And this afternoon, if we're on, I think you'll find that it gives you a pretty decent estimate for how fast your coffee cools. Okay? So it's actually generally very useful. Okay, just last overhead, we'll wind it up. I did want to just make a couple of comments about complications as promised earlier. Lars talked a little bit yesterday, or mentioned yesterday during the discussion about the role of phase boundaries on convection. And in fact, phase boundaries play an enormous role in the style of mantle convection. And so I'm showing the two examples and try to motivate the kind of things that happen when material, cold stuff or hot stuff rising, approach a phase transition. Okay, so we'll consider the exothermic case first. Here's the pressure as a function of temperature. We've got our low pressure phase, our high pressure phase, with a positive Clapeyron slope. We've been calling that exothermic. And so we imagine, conceptually, that we've got a piece of subducted slab, something cold, which is sinking down toward the boundary. So as we start to cool the region off in the vicinity of the boundary, we're going to move in this direction. We're going to move the position of the phase boundary to lower pressures. So what happens is, as this cold piece approaches, this boundary will tend to deflect up toward that piece. And because this density is low and this density is much higher, just like a pile of water in the ocean, this would actually like to settle. So this boundary deflection actually tends to enhance and drive convection. This boundary will drive down and it will superimpose with this to drive flow. At the same time, though, there's heat given off, right? Latent heat's given off in this particular case. This is going to warm this region back up, provide thermal buoyancy, which will actually oppose the convection. And so with every phase boundary, there's sort of good news, bad news. The latent heat very often opposes the motion. Well, at least in this case, it opposes the motion, whereas the phase boundary deflection enhances the convection. The exact opposite is the case with the endothermic boundary. So here we've got pressure as a function of temperature, low pressure phase, high pressure phase, negative Clapeyron slope. We've got a piece of cold material which is sinking down toward the boundary. So essentially, as the boundary starts to cool, the phase boundary moves to lower pressures. And so this region basically creates a divot in the phase boundary, which is essentially buoyancy, which would like to push back up. So it's going to essentially oppose this cold subducting material. At the same time, latent heat is being absorbed. That'll make this region colder, and that will tend to enhance convection. So in each boundary, you've got latent heat and boundary deflections adding in opposite directions. But the important point is that the boundary deflection effects become more and more important as the Rayleigh number goes up. And so as you get to very, very high Rayleigh number convection, which we think is appropriate for the mantle, especially at the 670 phase boundary, this deflection of the boundary can have an enormous influence on the nature of convection. It will really tend to inhibit flow across this boundary. And so there was arguments, suggestions, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, arguing that this phase boundary could actually layer convection. You'd build up enough buoyancy and get these avalanche events, which would then plunge material down through this boundary. So certainly, these are important complications. And if I were to sort of just conclude by saying, where is the future of mantle convection? Where is the business going? I would say probably three things. One is, what are the role of plates? People are working on trying to get rheologies to simulate or reproduce plate-like behaviors. Maybe even more important than that is, we'd really like to understand not whether we can make plates, but rather understand what the influence of plates are on the nature of convection underneath. Presently, we don't know. Second point is phase boundaries. I mean, we really haven't scratched the surface in terms of really understanding plate boundaries or phase boundaries, especially when we start thinking about the effects of compositional variations. And so there's an enormous amount of complexity that can arise when you start combining thermal compositional buoyancies interacting with phase boundaries. And then simply accounting for compositional variations like iron variations or other things are, again, going to play a huge role in the style of mantle convection. And I think all of these things are really up for grabs in terms of understanding how they're going to ultimately influence what we see in things like seismology in terms of the sampling that we make in geochemistry. Maybe I'll wind it up there. Thanks, Barbara. So we did all of fluid mechanics plus a survey of... So that was a lot, so I apologize for going so fast.
Can I make a general statement about
So the issue here is that you get essentially localization effects, right? So that as you start to heat stuff up, the viscosity goes down, which allows you to strain more, and so you can get these runaways. In fact, people have argued that some of these deep earthquakes might be these thermal runaways. I'm not sure, to be honest with you, what the status of that. So that would be taking these things to the absolute extreme in the sense of actually having them play a role in seismology, for example, right? But the point is that it almost certainly plays an important role in localizing deformation. No question about it. No, I don't think so. You have to be very careful about this stuff. You see it all the time. It's basically, how could I describe this? If this could work, if this system would work, I would be a millionaire, right? Because it would be a case of you put money in the bank and then you'd borrow that money and get interest on it or something. I don't know. But the point is that it's not an additional energy source, basically. Bottom line is the energy sources that you got to drive convection are you take out a certain amount of heat, how much? These shear heatings are just redistributions of energy. So they don't really drive convection per se. They just simply organize and influence the structure of convection. So it's not an energy source. The analog, again, if I can come back to the core, is the magnetic field generation generates a lot of heat through ohmic dissipation. But in a sense, that's not an additional energy source. That's just the conversion of what's driving the convection being converted into a different form. So you really can't, that's double counting if you were to add it, basically. Right. So when I said that the energy equation is a bit of a tricky one, it's because of some of these sort of subtleties, I think. And you very... Yeah. Well, that's not impossible because all I guess what you're doing is you're essentially redistributing the energy that you've got. So if you wanted to take the energy and redistribute it in a way that actually was sufficient to produce melting, no problem, right? But you wouldn't say that that's an energy source to drive convection. It just simply, again, I would sort of say the better way to think about it is it just reorganizes the structure of the flow. Probably is the best way to think about it. Yeah.
How important is it to bring down
the I think it's actually hugely important, but I think it actually might be more important for the core. And the bottom line is that every 10 years, it's sort of like with the sunspot cycle, we go through these variations where we suddenly think, not necessarily me personally, but people think that radiative transfer is, you know, important. Suddenly at some particular temperature and pressure, the mantle becomes clear and just radiates all its energy by light, by photons. The mantle is such a messy, dirty system that it's unlikely that that would ever happen. But the bottom line is, if it did, it would have an enormous effect, potentially. And so thermal conductivity is very important. Estimates of thermal conductivity, say, at the base of the mantle, range from anywhere, say, about 3 in SI units up to about 20. And that range has an enormous influence on the mantle, or on the core, rather, because the core only operates as a heat engine because the mantle allows heat to escape. So if the thermal conductivity of the mantle was very, very low, we wouldn't be able to get as much heat out. If the conductivity is too high, maybe we get too much heat out, and that's also a bad thing. So it's actually very important, and I think there are efforts to carry out experiments that actually answer that question, but I think we're still a long way away from seeing the fruits of that effort. Yeah? The question was, what do convection cells look like in 3D? And they can look like almost anything that you want, really, depending on what you get. So here's an example. So here's these three cases. You get, in this particular case, this is temperature. So there's a region here that would be, you'd think of almost as like a subduction zone. So you've kind of got convection coming down like this. You've got other various blobs of cold material rising down. Here you've got sort of another subduction zone. I guess this is spreading center. So this is a subduction zone here. You've got cold material and long linear sheets going down like that. On the other hand, you go to a stagnant lid type convection scheme, and you get very, very small scale thermal convection. So the point is that you can get a variety of different scales depending on what the parameters and characteristics of the problem that you're looking at. We think that the Earth basically operates in one which has large sheet-like plates which are the dominant source of buoyancy, driving flow by having these dense things sink. So that's consistent with internally heated, that you have a boundary layer at the top, and that drives most of the convection with downward flow. And you have somewhat of a passive return flow coming back up, but perhaps some small-scale plumes, like we saw in the simulation where we had strongly temperature-dependent viscosity, where we're getting these thin plumes rising up a very, very low viscosity region at the bottom. So it's probably what we think the Earth is a mixture of those two, sheet-like downwellings, most of the buoyancy, most of the driving force, and then these sort of smaller, perhaps slightly less important as far as heat transfer, plumes rising up from the bottom. So, but seismology tries to image this for us. Dynamics modelers try to reproduce these things, and again, here's sort of a source of potential comparison where you have seismologists making predictions, mineral physicists plugging their calculations into the predictions of mantle dynamics to ask, is that what seismologists see? And so I think increasingly we're seeing a very effective synthesis of these different disciplines to sort of answer the question, what does the structure of convection look like inside the mantle? And it'd be nice to know. Okay, yeah. Well, it depends in some ways on how you define it. If you define it with an internal radioactive heating, you get something on the order of 10 to the 9th. You know, if I put in these questionable numbers, or numbers that are questionable according to Stan, you get 10 to the 9th. If you just simply say a temperature jump of perhaps 2,000 degrees, what I'm really counting is the boundary layers. So the adiabatic increase in the adiabatic core doesn't count. Then I get about 10 to the 7th. What really is important, though, perhaps, is also the physical properties, like what's the coefficient of thermal expansion, other things. Guy?
Yeah, but they're varying within the system, so when you talk about
radar
and
mantle. Yeah, right. Okay, so this is another good point, actually. This is actually the only paper that I've actually ever published on mantle convection addresses this specific issue exactly, and that is that when you have a fluid with layered material properties, the whole notion of a Rayleigh number sort of starts not making unique sense, perhaps. But nevertheless, what turns out to be the case, even with strongly temperature-dependent viscosity, you still tend to get a convecting region where the viscosity is more or less homogeneous. Now, phase boundaries can change that, but it's maybe not as bad as you might guess. Yeah, so normally, yeah, for stagnant lid, which is an example, and we'll do the scaling for stagnant lid when we deal with planets, because it's relevant for Mars, it's relevant for Venus. The Rayleigh number is usually defined based on either the viscosity in the interior of the convecting region or at the base of the convecting region. But in the stagnant lid model, those two are actually not very different, and so they're very, very close. If you defined it in terms of the properties in the plate, of course, it would be nonsensical. Yeah, right. I mean, I guess the bigger issue is the estimate of the viscosity increase in the lower mantle that comes from things like post-glacial rebound studies and from dynamic geoid studies that say there's a factor of 30 or 40, 50 change in viscosity as you go down to the interior. And that would have a big influence on how you would actually define the Rayleigh number. And my again, sort of thinking back to this paper, which was actually a term project as a student, is that probably you'd define it in terms of the lower mantle, which represents the larger volume. And it would be these lowish values, yeah.
I had probably a practical question about the order of magnitude analysis to get the computer flux.
Okay, good.
Now, when you ultimately get this expression of Q is proportional to, say, W over 300 or anything.
Yes, yes.
The practical application would be, and first thing you're assuming is the Q that's coming out of the core is what's leading the surface of the Earth. You know,
right, okay, yeah. Right, oh, right, okay. No. Yeah, I got your question. So the question is, hey, wait a minute. You have this plane layer with heat coming in the bottom and then heat going in the top. They're the same. That's not like the Earth, right? Would that be fair?
Okay.
The bottom line is that, sure, we take the plane layer model, which has the same amount of heat coming in the bottom and the same amount of heat going up the top, but we still, in our hearts, believe that it's a boundary layer process. And so if we characterize the heat flow of that simple system in terms of just the temperature change across the boundary layer, we think that we can take that model and apply it to a fluid where it has different temperature jumps across the two different boundary layers. We believe that that's true. And with your coffee experiment, you'll be able to test it, right?
So the corroboration for that could be, I was just talking about, say your WP is your only parameter here, so you can use that to compute your boundary layer thickness at the upper and the lower.
Right. Well,
I mean, so would that somehow be able to give you an order? Because I was just wondering, the core mantle boundary, the boundary layer is assumed to be a few hundred kilometers. And
right.
The hypersphere talks at 100 kilometers. So order of magnitude are both the same.
They could be the same. But again, when we do the planetary stuff, we'll actually have a coupled mantle core model. And what you'll find is that the core will tell you essentially, or the interaction of the core and the mantle will tell you what's happening at the bottom. And then the surface will be a separate. And you'll see that those two things, in some ways, they can vary independently. But you'll see as the system evolves, they'll lock into each other.
But
right.
They're still linked through
yes.
The eddy right?
Yes. Yes. Right, but the bottom line is we still think about those two boundary layers as if they're independent, or think about them quantitatively as if they're independent. Right. Okay? Okay, good. Thanks very much. As we speak.
As we speak.
A failed experiment. It's a tensor.
Okay. It's
so this.
It's a second degree.
This divergence operator.
You want a vector.
Yeah, this divergence operator acts on the first velocity, not the second one. So if I wrote it in subscript form, which I was tempted to do, but then would require subscript notation, this would be partial with respect to J, VJ, VI.
Thank you.
Okay. Hey, Kanani.
I was wondering, so just off the question that Ravi was asking just now. So, you know, if they were to scale it, and you're saying they probably won't. I mean, because the surface area of the core mantle boundary is much different from the crust, or from the top, I mean, couldn't it just be, you know, like it's about halfway down? Couldn't it just be like a factor of 4 larger than the thermal boundary at the top or something, just to kind of, I don't know, like is there, could there some sort of, could you say?
Yeah, so the scaling that we derive for this little q would be the heat flow per meter squared.
Okay.
And so if you were going to then apply that to the, so let's suppose, for example, that the temperature jumps across the two boundary layers were the same, then we would say that, roughly speaking, the two heat flows locally would be the same, but when you actually applied it over the surface, because it's a much smaller surface, the heat flow out of the core would be much less, factor four. So we're really taking a local analysis, which is really heat flow per square meter, based on these sort of scaling arguments, and then putting that into completely different geometry, which we never derived it for, right? And then applying it and hoping it works. And it seems to.
Okay.
And it seems to work relatively well. I mean, better than I would expect it, basically. Okay? So what it really means is that the local analysis in terms of a boundary layer isn't really very dependent on the fact that that surface is curved. That would be the way that I would characterize that. In the same way that you can often do, say, flexure of plates and things at the surface with a plane layer approximation, if it's local enough, right, you can get away with that. And so this is an example of that kind of thing, I think. Make sense?
That was what, like, what's the scale of the convection cells?
Like, yeah, hard to say, really, because
the paper there in the tectonics class last semester, I was in the class, but I was listening to my office mate talk about it, and some person was arguing that there's, like, two main cells.
Right.
Earth, and that just seems kind of odd.
Oh, right. Okay. So what? Yeah. Right. So what people see in the tomography are two large regions of low velocity, which are interpreted to be hot material, which is rising. So you've got these two gigantic plumes, one in the eastern hemisphere and one in the western hemisphere, and it looks like that's the dominant pattern of upwelling in the mantle. Well, it might be true, but I think it's a little bit misleading, because if you really do believe that convection is mostly driven from the top down, from plates going down, that's where all the buoyancy is. And that these super plumes are probably interesting features, but I don't think that they represent a significant, substantial part of the heat transport in the mantle. So they're interesting from a seismology point of view. These super plumes were sort of detected by the people
at Caltech.
Didn't
they see things going, like, cold regions too, like there's, I think it was up in Siberia or somewhere in Russia. I think the hot spots were, like, the big ones were in Pacific and East.
Well, there's different scales, right? Like, so there are hot spots, and they're hard to image with seismology. These tend to be sort of very small conduits that supply sort of very localized heat flow to sort of spots. And so seismologists still debate whether or not they can see those.
The super plumes, from what I remember.
Now, then there's these super plumes, right.
One was in the Pacific.
Right.
I can't remember exactly where, but it's huge.
Right.
And somehow they had everything going down up somewhere in Russia, I think it was, by one of the...
Yeah, now that's a bit puzzling to me.
It is really odd.
The plumes and the super plumes are probably different phenomena. The super plumes are these gigantic, massive things. In all likelihood, they're probably iron-rich, so they're probably dense chemically, but light buoyantly. They're probably slowly rising up. They'll probably run out of thermal buoyancy and probably collapse back down again. Whereas the plume is the kind of things that you saw in the simulations, where you get these things rising up with heads on them often and tails sort of. So that's sort of the classic plume story. So, but yeah, there's all this structure, right? And we can't understand that structure with simple thermal convection models. And so what it means is that chemistry and temperature are playing key roles in the buoyancy and the structure of the flow. And so that's why I say the future of mantle convection is incorporating these chemistries and temperature effects into the convective process. Okay. Good.